Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. One of our retired professors, Shirley Ferris Jones, is a Civil War historian who has put together a compilation of articles she wrote for the Murfreesboro Post titled The Uncivil War in Middle Tennessee, and all the proceeds from the sale of this book go to the Rutherford County Historical Society, which is appropriate because that institution is charged with making sure that our Civil War heritage doesn't slip away from us. Very important in Murfreesboro and Rutherford County, site of the Battle of Stones River. And Shirley is here to talk with us today about her book and about her own family's, her ancestors' involvement in the War of Northern Aggression, if you choose to call it that. Thanks for being with us today, Shirley.
Thank you, Jenna, for inviting me.
Now, her name is Shirley Jones, and her husband's name is Jerry Jones, so we are breaking news on this program that the owner of the Dallas Cowboys is married to the mother of the Partridge family.
I had the pleasure of meeting the real Shirley Jones at a trade show with my husband in Chicago. In fact, I have a picture autographed by her from one Shirley Jones to another Shirley Jones.
That's terrific. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely
She was a lovely lady.
Oh, mm-hmm. She seems like a terrific lady. She was great in Elmer Gantry, too, as well as Oklahoma. The Uncivil War in Middle Tennessee, there is so much in here about your own ancestors. How did your family members over time preserve all of these documents, letters and diaries and things, photographs, dating back to the 1800s, the mid-1800s, late 1800s? And were you surprised to realize that you had this treasure trove within your own family of historical items, and were they in good shape when you found them? I mean, I can't believe you have all this stuff that seems to be relatively well preserved, at least to the point where you could read it from so long ago.
We're talking about two families. The Lowe family, my mother's family, settled in Rutherford County in 1810. They passed down this wonderful oral history that was amazingly accurate. I heard these stories recounted, the one about Calvin C. Lowe, my great-great-grandfather. When he served in the 23rd Tennessee Company B, served with Pat Claiborne at Shiloh, in fact, and when he was wounded, returned to Murfreesboro, then following the Battle of Stones River, his wife, who was in her seventh month of pregnancy, was stabbed in the stomach when some marauding Yankee soldiers came to their farm and decided they would take her chickens and apples, and she decided otherwise. She also had an opinion about their heritage, but we won't go there.
Uh-huh.
But my grandfather, Elgin Lowe, whom I adored, passed the oral history of the family down to me. He passed away in 1975, and it suddenly occurred to me that if this was not documented, if this was not preserved, it would be forever lost. So that was what got me started on this. It was something, I guess, that I took for granted. I loved the stories. I loved the accounts. I loved history as a child. But to really get seriously involved, researching, documenting it, writing it in a manner that would be preserved, that began in 1975. The Ferris family, my maiden name is Ferris. My father's family, on the other hand, were avid record keepers. They documented everything. And so after I completed my work, more or less, on the Lowe family, I began transcribing the diary of my great-grandfather, Dr. John Kennerly Ferris, from Coffee County, Company I, 41st Tennessee. He had written letters to his wife, Mary, during the war. It started out as a relief from boredom, something to do, but these soldiers knew that this was history. They knew that the things that they documented, whether it be the weather, what they had for dinner that night, or what they did not have, or, you know, just the general account, then that was history. And even though he was a doctor, he tried to spare his wife the horrors of the war. He wrote about the everyday things, the loneliness, the despair, joy, sorrow, and above all, that famous Southern word, honor. And so my father and I began that as kind of a little project as my father's health was declining. And we began that as a project together, and that was fun. And then, of course, I was kind of doing a little annotation. Now, why did they move from point A to point B? Were they guarding the railroad? Were they in retreat? Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing. But that was not published, unfortunately, until after my father's death. And then when my aunt passed away, I had this treasure of pictures, of letters, of family records that were just incredible. I mean, I knew that she had them, and the Ferris family kept everything, you know.
Was it in good condition?
It was in very good condition. It was amazingly so. And now,
given the fact that these people are not curators or professional historians themselves.
No, they just put it in a box and kept it in the bottom of the chiffarome. And it worked.
But with one side of your family tree being amateur oral historians and the other side being amateur written historians, it was virtually in your genes, wasn't it?
It was. I guess you could say my family never got over it. My father, he had these stories firsthand. His grandfather, Dr. John Kennerly Ferris, even though he had died before my father was born, my grandfather Ferris, daddy's daddy, had told him all of these stories and all of these accounts of, you know, what he had experienced, of what it was like being a prisoner of war. And of course, there in his diary is what he had to eat while he was at Camp Morton, you know. Mm-hmm. And there were just so many instances like that I could connect to the troop movement of the 41st Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Some of the articles or entries in this book are very Murfreesboro specific, and then some of them are more general to the overall war. Which do you find more interesting?
Some are very near and dear to my heart. Of course, the ones that I'm directly connected to, they have their own special place. But some of these stories, my main goal was to prevent them from being lost to history, was to preserve these stories. There are a lot of roles of women that I found very important, because this was the first role in which women could take such an active role, and boy, did they ever, without losing their status as ladies.
Let's talk about the women for a minute. How did these, the women who were, well, soldiering wasn't the only role, mm-hmm. of course, but how did the women who did integrate themselves into the Army as soldiers disguise their gender, or did they have to?
They had to. Some of them bound their bosom and fought beside their male counterparts on the battlefield. Sometimes they had brothers. Sometimes they had sweethearts whom they accompanied to war. And it came as quite a shock sometimes when they were wounded and they were being treated for their wounds, and oops, Sam wasn't really Sam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But women served in just about every capacity, whether it be a spy, whether it be getting medicine to the troops, hidden. There's a wonderful story on the article on dogs, in fact, is one of my
I like
My
that, too.
Ones.
We were going to get to that. I wanted to get to the women before the dogs. You know, priorities first.
Right, there you go.
Yeah. This is not just a story of a bunch of women sitting at home and weeping over their menfolk, although there, you know, there is some of that as well. But talk a little bit about some of the more activist role that some of these women took.
Well, the women, the first thing they did was to take a look at the situation and to see what was needed and how they could help. Keep in mind, women had no voice, women had no vote. Women, they were left in a society without their male leaders, whom they had always depended upon. But women proved their worth in just about every aspect, whether they not only were responsible for keeping the home fires burning, but in many instances they had to chop the wood in order to do so. They, following the Emancipation Proclamation, women were left with a society with many freed African Americans who had nowhere to go. Some of them returned home. That happened to my own Ferris family. And my father grew up playing with first generation sons of former slaves. But they had a whole new role, and they proved themselves. They proved that there was so much more under that bonnet than just a bunch of pretty curls. The Scarlett O'Hara stereotype is so wrong.
Now, we know that after World War II, women who went into the armed forces, women who went into the armaments factories and so forth, found a greater degree of liberation than mm-hmm. they had experienced previously. Was the same true with Civil War era women after the Civil War, or did everything revert back to the same two separate spheres of male and female?
I fear it reverted backward. When their men came home, the men were war weary, the men were tired, they were sick. They had been disenfranchised. They had no vote. They had no money. And women literally gave them a cause to carry on. Women tried, you know, they saw what was needed to be done. They immediately began banding together. They didn't want their dead soldiers, their dead husbands, sons, fathers, whomever, to be forgotten. So they began raising money, pie sales, ice cream suppers, whatever, to raise money to build statues to honor those fallen in battle.
Let's talk about the Negro troops for a minute. There is a scene in Gone with the Wind where African Americans are marching off, as one of them says, to dig trenches for the white man. But a lot of people are surprised to find out that there were quote-unquote colored troops fighting on the side of the South, but did they go voluntarily, or did their masters tell them to go to help the cause?
There were some of both. Some were conscripted into service. Some accompanied their masters and served, you know, in that capacity, whether it was cooks, whether it was wagon masters. And some, just like the white man, wanted to defend their homeland and do what they could to preserve, you know, their way of life. I mean, not that they wanted to remain slaves, certainly not, but it was the only home that they knew, and they wanted to preserve. They had hope for a better tomorrow, I'm sure, and they wanted to preserve their homeland, as did the men of the South. Nobody, I don't think, could foresee that it would, how long the war would last, the toll that it would take, and especially people of the South, that it would land right in their own front yard. The people of Murfreesboro, I'm sure, never dreamed that they would ever hear the rattle of musketry, the roar of cannon, or the groans of the dying.
Why would they not think so, given that they knew Fort Donelson was a pivotal point in the war? They knew about Jeb Stuart.
Well, when they enlisted, they thought it would be over in a very short time. Most of them enlisted for 10 months or less. And they thought that they were going off to war to fight the war somewhere else. And I really don't think that they ever foresaw that they ever thought about the ramifications of war. And along that same line, and the role of women as well, we all know that there is so much more to a war than the who shot what. Mm-hmm. And the ramifications of that war extend so much further than just the lines of battle. Mm-hmm. And that's what affected the ordinary folk. That's what affected every man, woman, child, every horse, every dog, every living creature was adversely affected, or affected in one way or another. Perhaps their way of life forever changed as a result of it, of the recent unpleasantness.
What was the aftermath of the war like for African Americans?
They had a very difficult time. In a sense, the 13th Tennessee USCT troop was formed right here in Murfreesboro. Mm-hmm. And they were, they were a Union supported troop. But I don't think they could foresee either that what awaited them. They were a people, many of whom could not read, many of whom could not write, many of whom had no means of taking care of themselves or their families. They had always been taken care of. And unfortunately, they were a people that nobody wanted any longer. The Union, the people of the North did not welcome them with open arms by any means, and that was extremely unfortunate. Some of them returned to their former masters, to the families that they had known and worked there, you know, and as a sharecropper, or worked on the farm just to have a place to live and something to eat. Times were tough. We had reached, in the South, we had reached the highest level of prosperity financially, educationally, agriculturally, that we would see for the next 40 years. In 1860, things were really good. We would not reach that same level of prosperity again until the turn of the century.
The funny thing that Dr. Bryn Martin in history told me was that the Confederate Memorial on the square, the courthouse here in Murfreesboro, used to be on a different side of the courthouse.
It faced down East Main Street. That's correct, huh?
And now it faces north. It was moved to where it would face north, as if to say, to, you know.
Well, Johnny Reb was protecting the citizens of Murfreesboro from the merciless invaders of the north.
Yeah. How did people who had been beaten so badly in the South hang on to their pride and their you know, sort of forget you attitude to the Yankees, even after they had been trounced so terribly?
It was difficult. I'm sure that it was a readjustment. Many of them just went on with the business of living and ignored what was around them and what they had to deal with. Despite all the uncivil actions that took place on both sides, there was humanity and there was goodness. Let me just share one with you.
Okay.
My grandfather, as I was telling you, my great-grandfather, rather, Dr. John Kennerly Ferries, Company I, 41st Tennessee, was from Coffee County. Following the Battle of Franklin, he had been placed in charge of one of the hospitals there. And so, and when after the Battle of Nashville, as the Southern troops were retreating back toward Franklin, on about December 17th of 1864, he was ordered to report to General Thomas. Well, having been a prisoner of war for 7 months following the Battle of Fort Donelson, he decided not to do this. So, under cover of darkness, he and two other men left Franklin. He did not report to General Thomas as he was ordered. It took him 2 weeks to get home to Coffee County. Now, keep in mind, he had not seen his wife and his little boy, Sammy, since the time of his enlistment on November the 21st of 1861, when he and his two brothers left Franklin County. They were originally from Franklin County.
And he was making this trek on foot.
On foot, under cover of darkness, without even a blanket. It was cold. He reached Coffee County, and his wife, who was staying at her father's farm in Coffee County, just before Christmas. He was sick. He was war-weary. He immediately began trying to rejoin Confederate forces. He described himself as an army surrounded. He could not do this. By this time, it's early 1865. The writing is on the wall. There were times, despite the fact that he was honor-bound, he knew that it would not be in the best interest for the South to win the war. But yet, he would not desert. He would not disgrace himself. Consequently, the area in which he lived was in desperate need of a physician. He took the oath of office, the oath of allegiance to the United States in March of 1865, less than a month before Lee surrendered. He borrowed a horse. He immediately began to offer his services to the community, everyone who was sick and needed his help. He put himself in danger. There was such ill will, such strong feeling, such uncivilness in the area that the Union forces assigned a soldier to guard him, to ride with him on his travels. That man's name was John Neese. He was with the 2nd Pennsylvania, and he was stationed in Chattanooga. John Neese was wounded. John Ferris treated his arm. They became good buddies, man from the north, man from the south. After the war, John Neese mustered out, went back to his farm in Pennsylvania, and he kept in touch with John Ferris. And he wrote to him, you know, my arm is killing me. The surgeons here say they want to take it off. You gave me relief. What did you subscribe? What poultice, you know, what can you tell me to do? They corresponded back and forth. This odd friendship. John Ferris invited John Neese to come to see him. This was after John Neese had invited John Ferris to Armstrong County, Pennsylvania, to come to see him. John Ferris couldn't do that. He had a farm. He had a practice. He had a family. He invited John Neese. Well, lo and behold, John Neese came down and spent the summer in Coffee County, Tennessee with my great-grandfather. He liked what he saw. He was ready to move. He bought land in Coffee County. He gave a portion of that land, and he gave money for a school and a church. He went back to to Armstrong County. He sold his land, and the next year, in 1867, he moved his family to Coffee County. My grandmother, my dad was the youngest of four children. My grandmother was born in 1878 in Coffee County.
Isn't that the way it happens so very often, that huge rifts over intangible things like ideology and big things like that get resolved on a very personal level when people actually get to know each other?
That's true, and they can appreciate the differences. And so many men actually forgot why they were fighting. That word honor comes up time and time and time again. Some say they were to preserve slavery. Well, I'm sure there were some who were. The majority did not own slaves. Mm-hmm. Some say they were preserving a way of life. They felt that, some of them being first generation men of men who had founded this country, they felt they had the right to secede. Some of them just did it because they thought it would be a good adventure, and they got caught up. They got caught up in the whole shebang. Yeah.
And Ferris, apparently his Hippocratic Oath was more important to him than mm-hmm. any allegiance to the Confederacy or anything else.
He did not feel that it was in the best interest for the South to win the war. In a letter that he wrote to Mary on dated December the 26th of 1863, he said something to the effect, God knows, if the South should win the war, it would be a tottering aristocracy. Had I known then what I know now, I would today be in Canada, C-A-N-N-I-D-A, making an honest living for you and little Sammy.
It puts me in mind, ironically, of Samuel Mudd, the man whose name became associated with your name is Mudd. That's
right.
Where that
mm-hmm.
comes from, for treating
John Wilkes Booth,
the assassin of mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln. Yet mm-hmm. his Hippocratic mm-hmm. Oath told him, his devotion mm-hmm. to his profession told him, you know, I'm treating a human being. I'm not treating a criminal. I'm treating the person.
My great-grandfather, I would say, fell into that very same category. He did not write to his wife very much about the suffering that he saw. She was a very delicate. She was a lady of the genteel South. He did not want to bore her or offend her with blood and guts and gore and that kind of stuff. But he was appalled at the suffering. He felt so badly that being a doctor, he might have just a little bit more to eat or be a little bit more comfortable. And believe me, he didn't have all that much to eat, and he wasn't all that comfortable. But he felt so badly about some of the men sleeping, you know, on a wet ground with a wet blanket under a tent that was soppy wet too, or not having a good warm meal or something, you know. He really felt their pain as well as his own.
Were prisoners of war allowed to pencil and paper to keep diaries? Were they allowed to write?
They were. And in October of 1862, after he had been released, he wrote to Mary that he was keeping a journal, that he had made notes. And the notes that he wrote to her in that journal of October, after he had been released, having been a prisoner of war for 7 months, he kind of backtracked and told her about the account at Fort Donelson, how he came to be a prisoner, how he, you know, how they had been at Fort Donelson, and it was things, just everything went bad that could go wrong, and he was scared to death. It was the first time he had been in serious combat. And then he said he looked around and he said that he determined that God had no more made him a greater coward than any of the other men there, and he stood straight up and marched forward.
You know, what strikes me about this is a great many guys who came home after World War II decided that just the shutdown just did not want to talk about their war experiences.
The same thing happened with men. You know, it is so difficult to research that period of time following the war.
But you seem to have ancestors who were more like today's confessional culture mm-hmm. in that they wanted to write about mm-hmm. it. They wanted to get it out of their system somehow.
They wrote about it as it happened. It is there is you have to rely many times on women's diaries following the war to know what a difficult time many people were going through and the hardships they were experiencing because men didn't want to talk about it.
Because women were, well, this is a stereotype, but women have been said to be more verbal and given to self-expression, having a need for self-expression.
Exactly, and I think that was the case. You know, if the, many women were illiterate, some of the women who experienced the greatest hardships were illiterate. They did not have a pencil or paper with which to write or any means to document their own thoughts. Many women who did keep notes, you know, wrote about the hardships. They wrote about how they tried to rebuild a society with their men war-weary, tired, sick, and many of whom had just given up. And it was up to the women, and the women of the South especially. I picked up the pieces and tried to put everything back together again.
We've got to talk about the dogs. We've got this. This was hilarious because, again, you go back to World War II and a great feature-length cartoon called Valiant that was about a little British pigeon who had to do his part for the war effort to help the RAF and protect the homeland. And there's a medal that the British give out to animals. Since World War II, they've given it out to pigeons, horses,
well
cats,
deserved,
dogs that help in the war effort. And dogs were part of the dogs worked for both sides, I take it.
Since the beginning of time, as long as there has been man, there has been a canine companion. And that article is very near and dear to my heart. I had Cairn Terriers for 26 years. And during the time that I was researching that article, I had two precious Cairns, Maddie and Morgan, named for Murfreesboro's own Southern belle, Maddie Reedy, who married General John Hunt Morgan. Mm-hmm. And I spent about 3 months researching that. It wasn't all that easy to research. But the time the article went to press, it ran in the Murfreesboro Post on September the 16th. Of 2007. On Wednesday, September the 12th of 2007, I had to have my sweet little Miss Maddie put down. She had cancer. I dedicated the article to her. The dedication was not in the book, but it was in the Post. I have never had such huge response. Emails, calls, cards. You know, everywhere I went, people were commenting. I've had dogs all my life. I've never had a dog to have cancer before. This was terrible. And I have never had so many dog stories. Heartbreaking. I boo-hooed for a month. And then I couldn't even go to Kroger's without running into somebody. And
But I love the story about the lady who sewed. She hid. You tell it.
She hid her own dog. She had a fur coat.
Yeah.
That was a fake fur coat, which she sewed around her own little dog, and it made her dog appear very fat, but there were very valuable papers. She was a spy, Mrs. M, and she carried papers to her general hidden in that extra fur coat of her little dog.
So her doggie was actually
a
spy.
Her doggie was a spy. That's exactly right.
And you talk about records of horses. More than 1 million horses, which would make sense, cavalry and all that died on both sides.
The line of thought was, hey, if you can't stop the wagon or if you can't stop the cavalryman, shoot his horse. Ouch. And there's a wonderful story, you know, about Nathan Bedford Forrest and his horse. He was behind enemy lines, and his horse was shot. They couldn't capture General Forrest, so they shot his horse. And he had such a gallant steed, he literally plugged the bullet hole with his finger. And his horse was able to carry him back behind Confederate lines. And, of course, when he removed his finger, blood went everywhere, and the horse fell dead.
Oh, man. That is a loyal beast. You cannot attribute that just to sheer instinct or dumb luck.
I was thinking to myself as I was writing it, now, if that wouldn't make you mad enough to really kill somebody, they shoot your horse or they shoot your dog.
Oh, man. The book is called The Uncivil War in Middle Tennessee by Shirley Ferris Jones. All proceeds go to the Rutherford County Historical Society. And if folks want a copy of it, what should they do?
They can send their check. The book is $25. They can send their check $4.25, plus if they want it mailed to them, please include $5 postage for a total of $30 to the Rutherford County Historical Society, P.O. Box 906, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, 37133-0906. Okay. And if you want me to sign it, just stick a note in there, and I would be happy to do so for you, for anyone.
Mm-hmm. Is there any personal contact information, like an email address or anything?
If they want to send me an email, there again, I'd be happy to do that. My email address is sjns422@aol.com.
Great. Shirley Jones, thank you for being with us today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.